Hey everybody, it's Jeff Babko, episode 6 of The Caffeinated Keyboardist. Extra caffeinated. Everybody was super jacked up on coffee. 2, 3, 4 cups were consumed, and we had a good time. The masterful composer, pianist, Billy Childs was with us. Grammy winner, Grammy nominated for his newest project, which is a tribute to Laura Nyro called Map to the Treasure. Also the leader of his jazz chamber ensemble. What a musician. And also joining us was somebody that he once taught, another fantastic piano player, Rhodes player, composer. He's currently the house composer for the Weinstein Company, and you may know him as being the last keyboard player with Miles Davis. Also gained some notoriety on the Stanley Clark, Billy Cobham, and Larry Carlton Live at the Greek record, and on tour with Seal and Alanis Morissette, Darren Johnson, Billy's one-time student. They rekindle an old friendship and mentorship. And we had also with us my good friend Scott Healy, who's been the keyboard player on the Conan O'Brien show, actually all of the shows, since 1993. He's still there as part of the Basic Cable Band, and he's got a new record out called Live at Kilbourne Hall. And he's a really fantastic keyboard player and composer. We had a great time. So we start listening to Darren Johnson play some piano here. And Billy was the last to arrive. And here we go. Episode 6.
Jeff,
how are you?
Good,
thanks,
man.
For coming over.
Sorry it took me.
You're cool.
Could I have some coffee?
Yes. Let me. What are you taking?
I don't know. Cream and sugar.
All right.
I heard you play in New York, and like I don't remember back in the '80s. I think.
Oh my God.
Somewhere.
Are you from New York?
Yeah.
So was it at the Blue Note?
It was either at the Blue Note or Sweet Basil, or
It might have been Sweet Basil.
Or I mean, it could have been at Lush Life, or I mean, there's so many. I used to go to clubs and play.
There was a Lush Life because I never played there.
Right. It must have been the Blue Note.
Yeah, Blue Note might have been with Freddie Hubbard.
It must have been Blue with Freddie Hubbard, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The most nervous I ever got.
Because I used to go to music all the time in New York in the 80s. Yeah. I mean, you could go out. I could sit at the bar at the Blue Note for $10.
Yeah, forget about that now.
So.
But the most nervous I ever been was at the Blue Note.
Oh, yeah.
Because Betty Carter sat in with Freddie one night.
Yeah.
And I don't know a lot of tunes. So I didn't know what she was going to call. Meanwhile, Mulgrew, Kenny Kirkland.
Oh, Betty Carter.
Betty Carter.
Oh, yeah. She does a million tunes.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Mulgrew, Kenny Kirkland, James Williams, Bernard Wright, the piano player, we're all at the bar. And I could just picture her saying, let's call something, you know.
Flying Setter to the Moon.
Yeah.
B flat.
Yeah, right. And then, oh, you don't know it? Mulgrew, come up.
Right.
Yeah. But she called What's New, and I was like, thank God.
Damn.
Oh, thanks, man.
Mm-hmm.
Are you from New York also?
From here.
From Los Angeles.
Like you.
My man.
Are
like
you?
All three of us.
You're the only transplant.
Yeah.
That's
cool.
Bizarre. Well, that's there's
why no
natives.
There are no natives, and three of them here.
Are you
and they play the same
LA or the
from
Valley?
I was born from the Valley, Granada
really?
Hills.
Granada Hills. Okay.
Parents went to Burbank High.
That's still cool.
It's close enough. It's not cool. There's
we're
nothing
we're
cool
actually
about.
From the exact same neighborhood. You know,
yeah.
Like we grew up within like a quarter of a mile of each other.
Yeah.
You know.
Wow.
Yeah.
At different times, you know.
Yeah.
He's older than
me. Ah.
Yeah, I went to Fairfax, so yeah.
Yeah, I went to Hamilton. Yeah. Went Hamilton at Fairfax.
Right, which those same. Two friggin' like rival schools. Yeah, as well, yeah. Man. That's,
was
that's
Hamilton
insane.
Already a magnet?
No.
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 No, I didn't.
We had Dr. Tiford. Oh, wait. Hold up a second.
You played a lot of music.
Wait
so
a minute.
I can say that.
Nah. The 50s, man. Damn, man. I was born in the 50s.
The swing era. That's what I can't say.
Yeah. The back in the swing era when I was going to school, we had Dr. T.
See, you grew up in the same neighborhood, really? Did you study with Billy?
I did. Yeah, that will be on record. You can put that on every record. Actually,
how old were you?
I said it just 3 days ago to somebody.
Yeah,
they were complimenting me on my playing, and I said, "Well, let me tell you how I progressed." Yeah, I was. 18 when I met Billy, and I was working as an usher at the Beverly Theater, which is now I think the Saban Theater or whatever on Wilshire.
Yeah.
And
that was a cool theater.
Yeah, the Chorus Line was there forever, which is forever ingrained in my head.
But also,
Billy was there, but he was playing
with John Clymer.
Yeah,
really, Clymer.
Yeah. I ran out of breath.
But you don't have a pedal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's the problem. You know,
actually, I had great times playing with John. We used to play at Pasquale's, too.
Right.
And we did some gigs with Jerry Brown played drums. This bass player that no one's heard of since is a guy named Darren Neesham.
Nope.
Played bass.
What happened to him?
He moved to San Jose. I still talk to him, and he plays, and you know, he switched to piano actually, and plays in clubs. And he's actually quite a remarkable musician.
I saw John Clymer opening up for Freddie Hubbard and VSOP Quintet in the must have been the mid late 70s in Cleveland. The show was great. They got through one tune, then they went into Maiden Voyage. Clymer was good, actually really good. But then the
Clymer could play, man.
Yeah,
Clymer could play, but
a lot of Echoplex. But they got
a lot of that. Yeah,
they got a couple bars into Maiden Voyage, and there was feedback on the Freddie goes up to play the melody, and feedback. He kicks the mic stand over. Walks out of the auditorium, and they vamp for a while.
Doesn't sound like
and then
camera.
Just concert was over. Like,
the concert was over. Yeah. There's a little bit of feedback.
Yeah.
Wow. At least it started. That's
you know, that's a start. But you were saying about how we met.
Yeah.
No, that was it. 18. I mean, and I think he was playing the Rhodes that he still has. He has a tendency to keep his instruments in such amazing shape. He still has the same grand piano at his house that he's had since I first met him.
Since I was 17.
So he had, so, yeah, he was playing, you know, Rhodes, which has always been one of my favorite axes. Yep. And I don't even know what was going on in the early 80s as far as sounds, but he had that on stage, which was great. And so, I mean, I bolted right after the show because I was really trying to get my fingers together. I'd been playing piano for 2 years, maybe. I started really late and ran down there, and so receptive and just like...
You talked to him, you were in your usher.
I think I even went to... or maybe I changed. I think I probably changed.
That's amazing.
I can't remember that far back, but it was more like, you know...
I remember where it was backstage.
I connected with you backstage.
Yeah.
And then he was like, just come on over. And we worked out a thing, and I would just go over there. And, you know, it's those lessons that, you know, when you're that new, that will, it's forever, man. I'll be 90 years old saying the same story. And it's just, you know, when you look at somebody play or you guys talk, and then he'll play again, and he says, you play, and all that kind of stuff. That's the way I want to teach. That's the way I think it should be taught. It's a very personal thing, and you have to either get on with the person or not. And so 30 years later, we're still knocking each other's heads, you know. So it's amazing, man. I mean, forever. Yeah. I had two guys in my life. He was one, and another guy just took me once I got to college and
where did you go to
spend time? Cal State Long Beach. Was most of my time. I went to Santa Monica College, but I was being an artist at that point, a commercial artist. But so anyway, I got to Long Beach.
I had a good program though.
It was fantastic.
John Prince, was he there?
That was it.
Yeah.
So John and Michael Carney, who since passed away, Michael was the one that saw talent there. And, you know, I had to catch up, but couldn't read, really. And so he'd give me the big band charts, you know, a few days before. I'd memorize it and,
you know, do my play, thing. But the
yeah, the feel was there. Everything, you know, it was all kind of, you know, all that. So yeah, that was it, man.
And then 6 or 7 years later, he's playing with Miles.
Yeah.
That's my 10,000 hour story in my book.
Oh, okay.
From the start of playing till almost 10 years. Yeah, under 10 years I was playing with Miles.
Yeah.
Of playing the axe, of playing piano.
You Were you the last keyboard player with Miles?
Yes. Yes.
We were on the last gig?
I was on the very last gig.
Did I see you with that show with the jackets and...
Yeah, that was the last. That was the last show.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, 91. I think August of 91. Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Where was that?
Yeah.
The bowl.
Yeah.
Wow. Man.
Yeah.
And David Benoit.
Right.
I had the. Well, I remember because I had the little thing they hand out on my wall, hanging on my wall of that show.
You know, my band opened for Miles one gig at someplace in Oakland, some theater in Oakland, and we were scheduled, we had like 45 minutes to play, but Miles made it so that we play a half hour and that's it, you know. And he had people at this at the backstage
like hovering,
ready to cut right. off the power if we went a minute over a half hour. I was like, God damn it.
Yeah, you know?
Because I had all kinds of shit to prove.
Right.
You know? Right. And I had a great band. It was like Michael Baker, Jimmy Johnson,
Right.
And Bob Shepard. Yeah, and right. we had all of this right in the middle of all of my Windham Hill stuff.
Right.
But we got our licks in for a half hour. But I really wanted to meet Miles. I never, you know, that was one time I was in proximity with him. And the other time was when I was playing with Marlon Jordan in Japan. And both times, and we were at a jazz festival where Miles was there. But both times he was surrounded by this entourage of people. It's like this impenetrable wall. And I it's one of the things I regret. I never just went up to him and said something.
But what if you'd gone up to him and he'd not been cool? Would you have been disappointed?
It would have been an experience, still.
You know, I mean, he would say some stuff that was so scathing certain days, and then the next day. Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely to me or to one of the other players or whatever. And you know, it's all like scattered phrases. You know, he would just say one thing, but it was like, you know, it meant everything, you know, whatever he said. And then the next day it'd be, you were the greatest thing since whatever.
Right.
And then he'd say another thing, a third thing that would just leave you guessing the whole night, sleepless night and that whole trip. And then you're calling the other dudes in the hotel like, what the hell, what was it, you know? And, you know, it was just that thing.
Right.
You know, that's part of... you know, being who he was, I think. You know, I'm thinking people like Picasso were the same way, and they, you know, just leave people like,
sure,
know, that kind of thing
forever.
You know? So for yeah.
Did you have to audition?
I didn't. No. The short of that, I mean, I'll make that really brief.
Please.
Was at that time I was playing a lot at Le Café.
Yeah.
Le Café was a great place.
I saw you there.
That had a lot of people falling in and out. You know, I remember Stan Getz coming in there on a lot of occasions. And Vince used to come in there, so that's where I met, you know, his nephew. Who runs a lot of the estate now. But, you know, anyway, Vince was like, basically, I dig what you're doing. You'd be a good fit for Miles's band. You know, I think we're going to get rid of the keyboard player pretty soon. And that's what he said. You know, so Miles would send him out to do a little scouting and that kind of stuff, you know. So, you know, the short of that is... You know, he's like, I heard you can play. This is what Vince was telling me. He was like, man, you know, Miles wants to check you out. Do you have anything? I was playing in one of his old partner's bands, Joey Heredia. Mm-hmm. We had this thing with Jimmy Earl and, you know, called Jazz Funk, I Like Go-Go.
Uh-huh. Oh,
and
right.
Tom McMorrin.
That.
And, you know, so I put one of those songs on tape. I put a couple of other things. Shifted off to Vince to give to Miles. And lo and behold, a week or so later... I was with Novak, actually, Gary. Miles got on the phone, and, you know, he was like, you know, I want you to come out to the house. So took a trip with Vince up to Malibu, 2 hours in. We're talking about catfish and painting and all that kind of stuff. And he started giving me dates. You know, he's like, Prince is writing some songs for me, and, you know, you fly to New York and blah, blah, blah. I go to New York, 2 days of kind of rehearsing, and then I'm off to Milan. That was the first show. I'll never forget it. I'm sure none of you guys would either. And I'm in Milan, and not even in the dressing room. I go on the stage, And then he comes walking out. And
then
you
have board tapes or something to learn the set? Or
how? Yeah, we definitely have board tapes.
No charts, right?
No charts. I made my own if I needed them, but basically it was just vibe, you know. And then you know the rest. I mean, the music is the music, and you know how he conducted himself. So I mean, that was it. It happened so quick, man. And then I knew from all the travel that I would be in the band for a while. I was like, oh yeah, here we are. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And then you know he passed away in September of that year. So I lasted about almost a year.
Now, on stage, was it a fluid situation, as they say in the military, where things are evolving and changing?
No, absolutely, man. It's how I try to conduct if I'm doing a gig. But, coming close to somebody like that, it's crazy. Yeah. You know, so, you know, again, the short of that is, like, he knew how to keep it flowing. He knew when to pull it back. He knew when, as you know, you've probably seen him give other people solos and hold up a card, and you know, never you always play it to an audience, you know, you never let it die down,
right?
You know, so it was just that, you know, every night, even if
so
he was sick,
beautiful combination of artistry and also showmanship,
God,
too. And but
oh
also,
and dynamics, players, man. Yeah. No one, man, very few people play with dynamics today. And you know, he was one of the kings of that, you know. I mean, it would be so silent,
right? Even in the studio, he's like that,
so absolutely, yeah. Which I got to do as well. I did his last record with him, and it was just him and I and the guy who was producing
DJ,
it, you know. So yeah, right? Yeah, he's a producer though. I mean, he knew about
right.
the chords and stuff.
Oh, that's
right.
Cool.
But everything he played was like, what? I mean, you wouldn't change a thing,
right?
So you know,
and yeah. He as a showman, you mentioned showman, he had gotten kind of looser as a showman at that. But I remember that last year he was getting friendly, he was holding up the cards, and he wasn't
fun,
turning.
Man.
He seemed to be having a good
yeah,
time.
Exactly, man. You know. But yeah, that's the legend that is.
That's not
that's
too,
forever.
Not
you know?
Too shabby.
That starts me off on my.
Now, was there just one keyboard in that version
yeah.
of the band?
Yeah,
yeah. Because
yeah,
there
it.
Had been two.
Mostly, yeah. A little bit before
that's
that,
nice.
There was two guys, and then I think Kay got in there, and he was the first one that was sort of.
There's the other guy from New York, Adam.
Paulsman.
Yeah,
always
yeah.
playing with two keyboard players.
Yeah.
So yeah,
he
always.
Did it for a long time.
Yeah,
it
was a long
yeah.
time. Yeah,
yeah, he was in on a lot of records. Yeah. Robert Irving and Adam.
Robert Irving
in on a lot
yeah,
of stuff.
It.
Yeah, so yeah, fantastic, man. Oh, life changer, man.
I can't imagine.
Life changer. Yeah.
What about you with Freddie? How did that happen? Different.
Yeah, that's a well. I mean, you know, it was different in the sense that it's a different person, and
yeah.
Freddie. I think they're both flawed individuals.
Freddie Hubbard, by the way, not
yeah, Freddie Hubbard.
Yeah,
not Freddie Prinze.
Yeah, not Freddie Prinze.
Yeah.
Or Freddie Prinze Jr.
Yeah, yeah.
Just for the listeners at home.
Yeah, just for clarification. Yeah, just for clarification. You know, Freddie Hubbard hired me because Larry Klein had the gig with him.
Yep.
And Larry and I had met in a theory class, part of the community school, which is now the Colburn
School.
School.
Yeah,
yeah, and it was kind of a preparatory school for pre-college musicians. You know, God, I got some. What are you serving here?
It sounds sexy. It sounds sexy to the listener.
Yeah.
Oh,
really?
Oh man, that Billy Childs. I'll
doesn't
tell you
feel
what.
That
he got
sexy.
A voice for radio.
He has a voice like he has like a coffee cake stuck in his throat. Really sexy voice. Anyway,
something for the ladies.
I'm not going to make my Bill Cosby joke right
now.
No.
Too
no.
soon. Too
oh,
soon.
Man.
Too soon.
What do you have in this coffee?
You don't want to know.
Yeah.
But we got to take a little nap later.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so Freddie, hired me back. This was back when, I joined his band in '78. But before that, like in the mid '70s, he was taking a cue from Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea and Wayne Shorter, who had moved out to L.A. and found huge commercial success doing their, like, fusion things,
yeah.
You know, Return of Forever, The Headhunters, Weather Report. So Freddie wanted to come out, but he started putting out not very good albums
yes.
in that
Liquid
vein.
Love.
Liquid Love and Windjammer and The Love Connection.
Yeah,
and
Love Connection's not terrible. Now, that's a borderline.
Yeah.
That's
I don't know, man. Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, in comparison
Windjammer,
to Windjammer,
not so much.
Yeah, not, yeah. His Columbia Records ventures.
Yeah.
So he had a band of, like, kind of like more fusion
funk guys,
people.
Right?
Yeah, great band. It was like Carlos Vega was in the band.
Yep.
Larry was playing bass. Dave Garfield was playing piano. Rick Zunigar was playing guitar. And then I think he put out Super Blue.
All right.
And he wanted to, and that was kind of a return to the straight ahead thing. That had Kenny Barron, Ron Carter, and Jack, and Joe Henderson.
Right.
And
George Benson on two tracks, just really? To keep the pop.
Look at you, man.
Oh, yeah, I love that record.
You know more about Freddie than I do.
Is this before, after Eternal Triangle and all that?
No, that's before. This is like 78.
About 78. Yeah, it was 78 because I joined when that album came out, and I had to learn a lot of those songs. Oh, yeah, that was one of the fun ones. Take It to the Ozone.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that was a great one. We played it a lot faster than they did on the record, you know. And Freddie would come out with these solos that, you know, if you listen to a lot of the live tapes, you'll hear the piano during Freddie's solo just stop because I'd be sitting there looking at him saying, I can't believe this is coming out of a trumpet.
Yeah, in front of me.
Yeah. You know, I'm witnessing genius, you know. And so I learned how to play jazz with Freddie. You know, I knew the fundamentals of jazz, but I learned how to play it on a sophisticated level, how to comp, how to solo in a more interesting way than I was, how to construct a solo, how to play dynamically, how to run a show, you know. Mm. And Freddie... you know, there are a lot of stories about him, how arrogant he was, how abrasive he was. But Freddie was the sweetest guy. He had a good heart, you know. It was camouflaged by a lot of bravado and hubris, you know, which I think coming out of the generation that he came out of, you know, playing with Blakey and playing with... these other incredible musicians. He practiced with Coltrane. He practiced with Wayne Shorter, you know. And, you know, as a trumpet player, you know, you're kind of like more out front. You know, it's more like you're proving yourself at every turn, you know. There's this like beautiful, healthy, but rivalry and competition with him and Lee Morgan, you know. They were...
Yes.
Where they respected each other and were friends, but there was still like an one-upsmanship, you know, kind of like in the bebop era, you know. And so Freddie had a lot of that, but at his core, he was a generous, kind person, you know, because I would, you know, there was no way I feel like I should have been in that. I wasn't ready to play with Freddie when I did play with him. And there were countless times when I would be like helping him with my comping, you know, like comping all over the place until, you know, and he just exercised the most incredible patience putting up with that.
Probably really excited. I mean, I can't imagine.
Yeah, I was like, hey, Freddie,
I got this.
Check this out. I got it. And check out this chord that I'm going to do behind you, man. Until he couldn't stand anymore. He'd just say, lay out, you know.
Oh, nice.
Which I would, you know. But it wasn't like, lay out, you little... and I'll talk to you after the show.
Right.
You know? It's more like a fly is buzzing around you and you just... Lay out. You know.
But he also must have known that you'd be better the next night too.
Yeah,
for it.
Yeah, he did.
So
and
he was developing you. He was
now. He would say lay out, and then I would use my own judgment when to come back in. And he never, you know, questioned that. And, and he would give me point. He was just a beautiful person, you know, to me. He was kind of like he was strangely paternal to me. He would like curb his behavior around me. I was young, you know, and he would like curb it to the best of his ability. You know, some nights when he was drunk and coked up and whatever, he couldn't curb it, but he would always make the attempt. You know, it's kind of like a father figure, an abusive father, but a father figure nonetheless. You know, I wouldn't be sitting here today without his guidance. That's just the way it is.
I remember that we talked about this when we hung at that that club, that restaurant a couple months ago, that your song on that Skaggly record.
Right.
You were writing like Billy writes for Freddie, and it's like that's not what the band was usually playing. Like,
wait, say that again?
Like you were writing your stuff, which is like, you know, not easy, and it's odd bars, and it's got it's informed by other music besides just blowing over changes and And I love that. I always loved that track on that.
Oh, record. You're talking about on Skaggy.
Yeah.
I wrote Rustic Celebration.
That song is still happening. And the cats are getting through it, man. But, man, it's such a
It was
a great,
laborious. It took all day to
imagine.
Do that song. Because
that's not what the band was playing mostly. Yeah. I mean,
Freddie read through it. Like,
wow. Sure.
You know. And Larry did a great job reading through it, and I'm going to leave it at that.
One, two, three, four, five, one, two, three.
I know, man. It was
Pro Tools. Yeah.
Freddie's wife, Briggy, called it industrial music when she heard it. Just like, and wow. It was Freddie liked that she said that, so then every time, you know, we referred to that song. Say, hey, Charles, industrial music. Ah! You know. this is really... Thank you. Thank you, Briggy, for that reference. You know. And we never played that song live.
Never live.
No.
We never did.
But it got me affiliated with BMI. Because Freddie... you know, that was another thing. He let me write a song for his album. Skaggly.
Because they used his road band on that record, which was... I remember thinking that was cool, because before that it seemed to be like session guys.
So maybe it was just a throwaway album or something. So
no!
Well, I'm going to use my road band for this one. But on the next really good one... I like it too.
Yeah,
it was my first recording in a studio for like a major label with a major artist, you know, and... There's an outtake. There's this one song that Hadley Kellerman wrote, which I can't find it anymore. I can't remember the name of it, but it was an up-tempo thing that was in minor sevenths moving up minor thirds, you know. And Freddie took the damnedest solo. I mean, it was amazing. And I can't find it. I wonder if Columbia has that.
Yeah, that would be...
Yeah, they should release that song, you know, and stop when the piano solo happens.
Oh,
I couldn't handle that tempo.
Oh, man. Could Hadley?
Yeah, Hadley could, but Freddie
drove
that tempo into the ground, you know. And Larry and Carl Burnett are just...
Kind of like... Was it Flanagan on Giant Steps? Or who's
that was me.
You know that version of just one of those things from that the Hub of Hubbard? Do you know that just one of those things where it's like the fastest tempo? That's like actual.
But
comedy.
they were all drunk or messed up.
Yeah, because it's
that
like
one.
A weird European.
That was with Eddie Daniels on it, right? Yeah, and Richard Davis.
That's right.
Who was the drummer? I can't remember.
Lewis Hayes, maybe?
Yeah, Lewis Hayes, right. And was it Kenny Barron, or was it...
It might be Kenny Barron.
No, it was Roland Hanna.
Right.
Roland Hanna.
All New York guys, right?
And, but they're like in Germany, right? It's like a night off.
And I think they were all messed up.
That's the fastest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's the guy. You know, that's the trumpet player for me. It's, you know, and it's hard for me to... There are some trumpet players like today that I really love, you know. Like Ambrose Akimuzuri. I love this guy's playing.
Yeah.
And I love Nicholas Payton.
Yeah.
I think Nicholas Payton, when I played a gig with Nicholas at Catalina's, and I remember we did this song from This Moment On, and that was the closest thing to Freddie, you know, that I heard. Not playing like Freddie, but playing with that same inventiveness.
Yeah.
And command of the instrument. It was unbelievable. I thought like I was playing with Freddie Hubbard, you know. He's a remarkable musician, Nicholas Payton.
There's this dive bar called the Oyster House in Studio City.
Yeah, yeah.
And Freddie used to go... Freddie used to go pick up food for his wife. And 2.5 hours later, she would call the bar...
Right.
Because the food was sitting in a paper bag on the bar and he was hanging out.
He was just
out.
Hanging. Yeah.
But that was so great because that's after his lip went. And he was in such a humble place,
yeah,
in a way.
Oh, yeah.
But the stories were still great, and he was super lucid and funny.
Yeah.
But there was a humility at the end because, you know, the chops, when he was saying he was still working on it, which is so sad to see it, like, athlete
really,
at the end, you know, after that was just sad. But he was really great. And like you said, really sweet and really kind and well, remembered.
Without the veneer of his brilliance of on the trumpet, he was left with just being Freddie Hubbard, which actually was a nice guy underneath all of that hubris, you know.
Right.
You know, he couldn't walk around with the glare of his brilliance of his trumpet playing to kind of shield people away from him, you know. He now is just him,
right.
You know. I kind of missed, you know, I remember talking to him during those times, but I kind of missed the Freddie that I grew up with.
I can't imagine.
You know, because I didn't mind it. I had a way of communicating with Freddie that cut through a lot of that stuff. Maybe it's because he felt, you know, kind of paternal towards me. Like, that's the only word I can think of, you know. And he kind of wanted to usher me into this music. And
he respected you, obviously. He put a tune of yours on your first record. I mean, clearly there was a thing.
Yeah, he respected me, and that, you know, and that's incredible.
Well, you were young, too, and these guys were young when they were pioneers.
Yeah.
They know, they remember what it was like to be over their heads or stretching.
Yeah.
Because they were not old men when they were inventing inventing music in the 60s.
Yeah. And he was, you know, he had that concept of a legacy, you know, kind of this apprentice mentor paradigm in music that's kind of missing now. I mean, it's the same with Miles, I'm sure, you know.
But with guys like Freddie, it's always amazing because they were all young and none of them seemed to have a mentor. This stuff just sort of happened.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of this music just happened, like sort of the way it happened at the end of the 50s. Music just took off, you know. So did film and theater and comedy. But then in the 60s, it happened again too with these guys.
Yeah,
now
it's in the academic world.
It's in the academic world.
You learn kind of in a lab.
Well, that's what
environment.
That's what Nicholas Payton talks about, right?
Yeah,
on some of those blogs,
Brantford,
right? Yeah, he goes crazy.
He says he doesn't even like the word jazz.
Well, I know, bam.
Right.
Yeah,
bam. Right, exactly. Right.
Yeah. I'm gonna go play some bam tonight.
That's some deep stuff there.
And all of that bam.
Yeah.
Right.
I always thought there was a big break off. I mean, as far as the academic thing that you talk about and how the European vibe got into the jazz world, and it's definitely a different sound.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and I appreciate it. I think I've come to I like some of these newer guys that are coming out as well. You know, but when I was talking to Kenny Garrett on one occasion last year, you know, he rekindled this thing in me as far as like the way, say, Africa, you know, the father used to pass a story down to the son who used to pass, you know, that kind of thing. Wherever the break was with that, I don't really know. But see, he's still at, you know, 50 plus or whatever, still cuddles up to Bobby Hutcherson, or still, you know, would find Joe, seek Joe out and just to get that thing. And I think that's the connection, because there's some amazing players, of course.
Yep.
But when you talk about the level of depth and going this way down instead of, you know, laterally or whatever.
If your coach is a YouTube clip of a you get some information, but you don't get the why.
Yeah.
And
you got to get that from those guys that are left and from, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I know Kenny was one and still is one that just sort of, you know, actively, you know, seeks that out, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's awesome, man.
Enough about me, man.
I'd like to ask, I sat around in the 80s waiting for the Miles to call me to play in his band, and it never, phone never
your
rang.
Phone was busted.
No, my phone was, I had an answering service.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
that would have been my dream come true, is to play with Miles.
Mine too. It's in my yearbook.
Me too.
What goals, and it says to
play with
Miles
Davis
if he's still alive.
Wow.
That's a big if.
Yeah, it's less effective afterwards.
Yeah, right.
Being as bad, it has less weight, carries a lot less weight.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I feel like I spent a lot. We have a lot of common ground through composing.
Mm-hmm. Oh right. Yeah.
Because during the time I was waiting for Miles to call me, mm-hmm. I was mainly a composer.
Yeah.
And I know you have a very serious background. And not just jazz composing, writing for bands, but also legit. Classical
mm-hmm.
crossover.
Yeah.
And I've always sort of struggled with that, having a classical background, mixing that with jazz writing, and
right.
then getting into the jazz head, of course, as a player.
Yeah.
But also having a reverence for the tradition of classical music and
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
But you don't, Billy, it seems like delineation is...
You don't
is,
have any kind of boundaries.
It doesn't seem to be there, which is so cool.
I try to, I don't see any difference. I must take exception to one little thing. I don't really refer to classical music as legit. That means that everything bad. Else is illegit.
Illegit.
Right. I withdraw that
point. No.
I withdraw that word.
It's a good point to be able to make, though.
Yeah. But I have this bass player friend of mine, Darren Neesham, who lives in San Jose now. He and I have arguments about it all the time because he thinks it's valid to call classical. Well, it is legit because, by legit, it's some double talk, rationalization, mm-hmm. explanation he gives me, but it's just not. But this is not a slam at all.
No, absolutely. It's sort of coming from the, I went to music schools and that's what they called it.
Yeah.
And I always hated it.
Yeah. I don't see. It's all music. I know that sounds new agey and holistic to say, but it's true. The same components. The ultimate goal for me is for music to connect with the listener, on a visceral level, so that they get the drama of what I'm trying to do. And some of the most incredible masters of creating dramatic scenarios are the Europeans. Ravel, Debussy, Bartok, Hindemith. Stravinsky, and they just have this thing about structure and harmony and counterpoint and orchestration, and I was fortunate enough to, I studied at USC, I got a degree in composition from USC, but I had one of the most incredible teachers ever in my life. I had three major music teachers. I had Freddie Hubbard, Robert Lynn, my composition teacher, and Marianne Usler, my theory teacher. But Robert Lynn was my composition teacher, and he was, he studied with Darius Milhaud at Mill College, and I think Dave Brubeck studied with Darius
Milhaud. Sure, he
Milhaud.
Did, yeah.
And
sure.
Milhaud was interested in jazz as well, mm-hmm. as was my composition teacher. So he was able to, tell me how to relate what was, my language into classical techniques, and how to use it. And plus, I'm 57, so I grew up, the music that informs me, like when I was 14 and was impressionable and was influenced, what was happening was fusion, where these incredible, combinations of influences came together and tried to, kind of blend into this organic whole. So and the music was very ambitious. You would have Yes coming out with Close to the Edge, which right. is like...
Were you listening to that stuff?
Yeah. I got sent to this...
EOP was a big...
The thing that got me to play piano. Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Really?
Yeah, because my parents sent me
Did
to...
Did you ever tell Freddie that?
No, I wanted to keep my gig.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Larry Clark, can you play more like Greg Ligg?
Yeah,
really
yeah.
like the way.
And that's exactly
rocks.
Why you can't
well,
swing.
I think we should have a band called DSOELP.
Yeah, I like that
DSOELP.
Too.
DSOELP. Well, I think Hendrix was one time talking to Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. They were trying to get Hendrix. Mm.
Right.
Band,
oh, Help. Yeah. Right,
and it was exactly. going to be Help.
Yeah, Help. Yeah. It's not a joke, actually.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's real.
That's.
But so I grew up in that era,
Sure,
and,
yeah.
And that's what, all of this music kind of coming together in an organic way,
Yeah.
Mm. is what I try to do constantly, you right. know, with classic.
What's the true meaning of what fusion, that word that's become kind of a
dirty word? It was also incredibly confusing, though, because I remember hearing Chick Corea, Now He Sings, Now He Sobs, and then, like, that evening going and seeing him at the Palace Theater in Cleveland with Stanley Clarke and Lenny White playing No Mystery.
Right.
Which, I mean, wait a minute. Is this the same guy?
All bets were off that.
I don't hear any blues. There's no, it doesn't swing.
But No Mystery also.
This is killing me in a different way.
And No Mystery is like Return of Forever, and noted for its heavy guitars. And, but No Mystery is a completely acoustic, almost chamber piece.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds like it could be a string quartet.
Yeah. You could learn that piece, and then you could also transcribe the fusion stuff, and then
I learned No Chick's Mystery as influence. If it was Chopin. The teacher had a book, a music
there
book.
There was a book of it. And I learned.
Yeah,
that
that's right.
So I got it. I got that book. That was it's a pink book, right?
Yes, right.
With the keys.
That's how I learned those. I think even before I heard that record, I learned it, which was kind of cool because it was the same as learning whatever classical repertoire I was supposed to be.
And I learned the solo to Matrix off of Now He Sings, Now He Sobs out of Downbeat magazine.
Wow.
Really? I don't even know the head of Matrix.
I started transcribing.
Well, I know. I could sing it badly. Oh, yeah. I don't know how to play it.
That's
for some reason how it developed. They didn't publish the head, probably because of the head of
paper. Yeah, they can't do the publishing, right?
But the whole solo was transcribed.
Was there,
imagine a national publication of a solo like that.
That's such a great solo. It develops. And
Downbeat has changed.
I know. Well, Downbeat.
They gotta sell copies.
Remember that Downbeat that had that little disc when Herbie's demonstrating
the
roads?
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And he's talking about. And this song is the theme from The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
Right.
A dubious title for a movie.
Yeah.
But.
That's a great soundtrack.
Yeah. And it ends up being. And it ends up being actual proof.
Right, which was before it was called actual proof, right?
It was the theme. It was what he wrote for this movie, The Spook Who Sat by That Door.
They finally reissued that, I think.
The movie?
Yeah, the soundtrack.
Yeah, I mean, I have it. Yeah. You know, it's a story of a black CIA operative who takes all of his intel information, to gangs, and then they end up taking over America.
Did you see the movie?
Huh?
Did you see?
I saw the movie. I rented
That's
it.
Awesome,
yeah.
Man. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, then actual proof turned into.
And you did you first hear that on that little sound page that came in the magazine?
Actual proof.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's when
put
I
a penny on it so it doesn't wobble.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Place a coin
on the needle thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to place penny here in case of
war. Exactly. Yeah, so I heard it there, and then I heard Herbie play it at the Roxy, where he was opening for Tower of Power, and they played actual proof before they recorded it on Thrust.
Was it Mike Clark?
And it was that band. Uh-huh. You know, it was Mike Clark.
Could they get through it?
I was like, "What? Yo,
what
man,
is this?
What is this? This is
That's
some alien
unbelievable."
Music. Anyway, what's your story, man?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I've got a background in composition in classical piano, and
Where'd you study?
I studied at Eastman.
Oh, cool.
And I mean, I had a
pretty good school.
I had one teacher who hated jazz. I mean, I always wanted to be a jazz player.
Yeah.
But I was studying classical composition just to because it felt so mind expanding, and I felt like I really wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. Even though I also wanted to be a player, it's just a very strange.
It's kind of what happened.
Identity crisis. Which, thank God, I kept playing. You know, because I've been professional on both for so long. But one of my teachers was very strict German, wonderful composer, and he taught me how to write theme and variations and a fugue but very stifling creatively. And then I studied with this amazing composer, Joseph Schwantner.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Schwantner, who just won the Pulitzer Prize.
One of the greatest band pieces that, I can't remember the name of it, but did he win the Pulitzer for that?
He won the Pulitzer for Aftertones of Infinity for orchestra.
Oh, okay. Well, this is a band piece. It's a beautiful piece.
He was into anything.
Yeah.
He could take your ideas, as you say, your jazz ideas or your sort of more creative improvisatory ideas mm-hmm. and channel them into your classical technique.
Exactly.
Because wow. you need that. Yeah. As a writer, you need that technique.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As you know, I mean, the best jazz writers are not piano players necessarily; they're trombone players. Because you know, you can't just sit down and
Bob
play.
Brookmeyer, yeah. J.J. Johnson.
You just can't. You know, the piano players can be really bad jazz mm-hmm. writers because they just play Don in Sebesky the middle of the piano, and then they write it down just like they play it, and it just sounds mm-hmm. like you know.
Well, if you played second or third bone, in which I have
right.
in a band for long enough, and you have to play, you know. You know, the third right. and the seven, yeah. and you never get them. I think you start hearing from the inside out.
Right.
Because it's about as far as the text. It's kind of the worst.
Well, it's funny.
Especially if you're the mom of the kid practicing the second part.
Right.
Boy, when are you going to get a melody?
Can I get some more coffee?
Yes, you can.
I could always hear those inside parts, even when I was. I remember listening to television in the 60s.
Yeah.
And hearing harmony and being able to hear this three going to seven and seven, right. this the 2-5 and you know, uh-huh. not you know, dominant to going to tonic or whatever uh-huh. as a kid. And my uncle had a Dixieland band,
uh-huh.
and you know, the trumpet was frequently playing not the melody or an inner yeah. part, and the trombone uh-huh. was playing those inner notes,
uh-huh.
so
yeah.
You had that polyphonic counterpoint happening.
Wow.
So yeah. I had that in my ear as a kid.
Wow. Yeah. Wow, you studied with Joseph Schwann.
I did, dude. And
he's one of my favorites.
I'd say, hey, I want to do yeah. something that's got some improvisation. He would be like, oh, I mean.
Yeah. That's how Bob Lynn was.
These are five ways to write improvisation. Yeah. Well, how do you write it? What are you talking about, maestro?
Yeah.
Oh, there's so many ways to get your band to improvise without actually telling them what to do. Here's proportional notation. Here's yeah. spatial notation. Right. Here's how what I
aleatoric music. And
here's how to write aleatoric rhythm. Here's how to write rhythms without pitches.
Yeah,
he had this whole thing where he said the quarter note pulse is wrong. This isn't a quarter note. Humans don't naturally hear quarter notes. That's too rigid.
Yeah,
we hear
like in threes.
No, we hear a much.
Thanks, man.
Much more, and we're gonna hear all over the country.
Thanks, man.
Computers being turned off right now.
Oh no!
Not after I edit the shit out of it.
Say it.
Instead of hearing one, two, three, four, anytime you play something that crosses the beat interferes too much with the phrase.
What do you mean by that?
Say you want to play you're playing da 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 da, there's your phrase, da 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 da, it's all nice in time. What if you want to go da 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 da? How do you get the player to not interpret that strong beat? So they're not going da 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 da, so they're. And his idea was that his idea was that the quarter note was this long,
right? To hear it,
and I'm stretching my arms all the way out to the side.
Yes,
yeah.
I'll get a picture of that to post.
Yeah.
So that's why all his pieces have like groupings of 14 quintuplets or 14 30-second notes in the space of five.
Yeah. Well, it's more
his
like
quarter
a
quarter note is like one. Mm-hmm.
And it's more like a suggestion of how to play that.
Two.
Yes. Or a map, almost like we should be around here at the same time, but the phrase has to be round.
Right. So, to my understanding, his idea was that his our natural our metric thing is 16th note. Two.
Dun, 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 dun,
and this works really great with like a jazz ballad, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can play this. Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
And you can actually write that rhythm out.
Yeah.
Not to get a classical musician to play that might require a little bit of coaching.
One also is one would have to feel it to make it sound
you have
natural.
To feel it.
I mean, and that's
well, you'd have to understand the intent behind the phrase. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like this is fast here, for this reason, and then it gets a little slower here because it sounds cooler, and then it lands here. So I have to make this first part fast, then this first part in the middle, and then land here, you know. And you just have to get that in your head.
Right. And you would also always want the other players to see the other players' parts.
Oh, cool.
So frequently, at least in the smaller chamber pieces, the all the players would see the, read off the score.
All the parts,
So you could see the flute was going, and at the top of his run, you would come in.
Yeah.
Right.
Sure. Without having a conductor going, you know, boom.
Play. It's fire, trial, fear.
And each player must have their own page turner, because the one page of score, you get through that.
No, his scores were so beautiful and compact and artful.
Really?
He designed his own pens, so everything fit perfectly.
Wow.
Oh, it was just this awesome. He had a whole process.
What a character.
Yeah, it was a character.
Is he still alive?
Yeah.
Where is he, in Eastman still?
No, he's no longer at Eastman. I actually just Googled him a couple weeks ago, and it was unclear on his website where he was in residence.
Oh.
Maybe I don't remember, but he's been very active. He's written a lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. He's a great composer.
But as far as channeling, like kind of like that, the creative impulse of jazz into a classical, standard, you know, legit, whatever format is... He really set me on that path.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question now that we're to Scott. Okay, and actually for all of you, something I want to ask you guys. Scott and I both have TV gigs.
Right. Whoopee. Yeah, it's great.
It's great. We're so grateful. We're so thankful. We do, though. But, this is an interesting question and something I deal with a lot, and I'm sure you do, and I'm sure all you guys do, that the delicate balance of art and commerce.
Mm. Right.
Having a day gig, if you want to call that, within the music field, which isn't necessarily uber musical per se. You know, you're playing 12 seconds of high energy music into commercials, and which is a great way to make a living.
Right.
Really is. I mean, really. Nice. But you're not necessarily going to get super inspired, or you're not going to, you know, sow your creative oats.
Uh-huh.
You can make a living, which is great. You can stay in town, which is great. You're on your instrument, which is great.
Right.
But I mean, I know even Billy with you, when you go out with Bodie or Darren with your gig, which we haven't discussed, or we're taking a pop tour or whatever, like the Seal or whatever it was. How does one manage? And I'm asking not just for the listener, but for me, help.
Well, it's funny because the way I met you, I heard you play with Larry Carlton in the Blue Note.
Oh, I totally forgot that.
In New York.
Right.
And it was
I reached out to you after you wrote an article in Keyboard Magazine.
Right. That's right.
Scott wrote this really cool article in Keyboard Magazine.
I had a monthly column. It was called Session Sensei, which I hated that title when the editor
named it. Worked.
But I thought it was actually kind of cool.
It was catchy.
Cool,
uh-huh.
So every month I'd write, you know, 600 words of advice or something, a session I'd done, or, you know, show up or be prepared.
It was super real world, and it was really, whatever you wrote that month, I wrote to the email address listed in the magazine. I said, and you were doing Conan in New York at the time.
Right.
And then you invited me to the show, which was cool. I was out there. And
I totally forgot about
and
that.
And then you came to the Larry gig.
Right.
But I remember thinking how cool it was that you were still... Because some guys get a TV gig or a regular road gig or whatever it is, and they check out of the creative side. They're good. I'm done. And that's cool. If you can do that, it's a peaceful life.
While you were thinking of that.
What do you do?
I mean, I don't know what I do, but it shifts every day.
Because I saw you that one time at the Blue Whale with, I think it was Tim LaFave and Mark Giuliana.
Yeah, that's right.
And the producer, what was his name?
That's Troy Ziegler.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was some great creative, the stuff that you were, I mean, I love the whole group, but the stuff you were doing really was interesting to me, and it was very creative and very...
I live for those, that's what...
Yeah.
I live for gigs like that.
It doesn't seem like this show has affected your creativity in any way, and your ability to improvise and think on this, and do everything that, you know, a creative improvising musician does.
That gig, well, Mark's a great, you know, catalyst for making things like that happen. He's so fearless and such a, he'd kind of goose you and just let you be you, and that's a really fun group because everyone listens.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes if everyone that's what makes that group. Everyone's really listening as kind of. I think of that group as four producers. Like everyone's kind of producing the moment, yeah. And that way you don't play, and that has just as much weight as when you do. And
that's cool.
That guy, yeah. You know, and that band really has that. It's like we're all kind of. Oh, do I need to throw anything? Would I mute this if this was right, in the studio? So thanks, but those gigs. Yeah. That's really the things that make it.
That make
it.
And to me, it's like who you surround yourself with, how you balance your life. You know, you might do your gig, but if you keep focused on being creative, I think that it's all an internal.
We also talked about this when I saw you at Blue Note. I was like, well, how did you take off the show? I don't know. And you said I go out when I can.
Yeah, I think that was, I remember exactly, that was 2005.
Yeah.
It was whenever Katrina happened. Right. Katrina happened that week, I remember. And, really? Yeah. Okay. And I think I did take 3 days off.
You
might
have taken off. And, I would take off for that, definitely.
Yeah.
For Larry, sure.
Yeah.
The problem with New York is that a lot of these artists are not based in New York, and a lot of the road stuff happens from LA.
Oh, it's out here, man. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think... You know, as much stuff as I've turned down to stay on Conan, I think it would have been much more tough if I'd been out here to turn stuff down. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I would have.
That's always a stressful call. I really try to be respectful to the TV gig because they're respectful to me and they're allegiant, and I really respect that. But you know, there are times where, and I have a really good relationship with the musical director and the producers, so I always. Try to make it clear, and it's, believe me, you can ask my wife, I stress about it. Every time a call comes in about other work, I'm so excited, yet equally, I gotta figure out, someone's gonna be disappointed, I'm not gonna be able to do both.
Right.
How do I, it's kid gloves for everyone, you don't want anybody to feel slighted, I'm honored that they think of me, and it's great to have that problem, but it's a challenge, and then, also, I mean, I wonder about, you know, when we're doing a pop gig or doing our TV gig or, you know, whatever it is, not us, not what we would necessarily choose to do on our own gig, being supportive. How do you stay engaged in that gig when you're there?
How do you stay engaged and how do you tell people that that's not all you can do?
Well, yeah. That's
there you go.
Right?
And that's where I'll come in on that part. Because when you gave me a compliment on something that I had done, you know, seemingly 1,000 years ago.
Right.
I did my little researching as well. I've known this guy over here, Billy, for a number of years. I've seen him develop in his own way and the courage. I think
almost 30 years.
Yeah, I've seen the courage that it takes to sort of carve out that path or a certain path or wait for a grant to happen or, I'll go out on the road for a minute, but no, I'm just going to, you know, whatever, just do his thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's amazing. So I'm surfing around and I'm checking out Conan's piano player / whatever, you know, whatever and whatever. And I'm like, wait, what? All these cross references. Like, okay, he's on the show here, but why is he conducting right now? Why is he doing? And he, Eastman, what? You know, and what? So I'm like, I'm scoping around.
You see why I'm a crazy.
I think
crazy.
To that point, why I sort of chimed in is that, and I'll say a brief thing about me, but just to the point was, it is our responsibility as heavy players, man, and
trying to lose weight.
We're heavy hitters, and when you get on a TV show or on a tour, whatever it is, I would think it's at a certain point you have to. They have to know. They know what they have, but then they don't know what they have. The audience may know, they don't know, and it doesn't matter if it. However, it happens, but just looking at your story and seeing you. And then I'm knowing you're on Conan for a number of years and knowing this guy forever. It's like they have the heaviest of the heavies. And that's what needs to keep being like stepped up every time a little bit more. This is what I do. This is what I, why don't you guys try this? Do you want to try this now? Mm-hmm. Hey, why don't we do a little, a little 5-minute portion of the show with just a string quartet and anything, just like ideas.
Right.
You know, I remember when I played with Alanis, again, this is like 12 years ago. I kept giving her stuff quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
That was like something that I'd love to do, you know, just anything. And she would, it would perk her ear. It ended up where I'm like, never happened before. She'd never had a keyboard player in her band before. But, you know, it ended up where I'm on stage like for 8 minutes to 10 minutes a night just playing solo piano. It's kids out there.
Right.
These are like 15-year-old kids That's who beautiful. Want to see her for 90 mm-hmm. minutes, not some dude that loves Herbie or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's like, but I'm giving them something.
How'd they react?
Oh my God. I mean, just, you know, because it works in any setting. It doesn't matter if it's at the Blue Note or
what Square age.
Garden, if you come from a certain place. Yeah. But it was starting to become like, she knows what she has. Mm-hmm. Now everybody else knows what she's got. And there's a lot of heavy hitters back here, you know, that are behind her playing this music. And that's, I mean, even the situation I'm in now, it's like, I'll do what you want. I'll give you, here you go, man. You know, here's Vienna Pro with some great, you know, whatever you want. But I'm also going to continue to sort of, you know, inform you about things that I love. That's
enrich
always
and
enrich your life.
And
you know,
interesting for the audience, you say, like, how do they react? I think sometimes if given a safe platform, like, we know what this is, you're going to get the hits.
Yeah,
but you're going to get something new. And sometimes when given a safe, like, comfortable venue, like, we know what we're here for.
Right.
But this is new. Suddenly your ears are more receptive to newness, and now you've just opened up and. They didn't even know you were spoon feeding them some new shit.
And that's all we have to do, you know, is just keep pricking those holes. You know, I mean, funny thing I saw when Herbie was playing Actual Proof with Questlove's band, whatever that show is.
Yeah, right.
Or whatever. It's like on the commercial
outtake,
or on the break.
Right.
Like,
and they posted
outtakes.
It.
It's the intake.
I'm with you. Yeah. Put
it
on the show.
Or the 12 seconds that you play some other stuff.
And you know what's too bad? Like, TV's gotten so, and you may have the
same.
But
it can change.
But
yeah,
it's a miracle that Actual Proof ever even made it for 12 seconds.
I know, right?
That's a miracle.
But you know what's happened?
But they played the whole tune. They were like so.
They've gotten so, at least at our show. Right. This isn't a diss, but it's just the way it is. Everything is managed. Every second is managed. There isn't. You think about Letterman in 83 when you got Hiram and Steve Jordan, and they're going.
They're going off the deep end.
And there's dead air, and it's awkward. Or there's that great clip of Johnny Carson and Doc Severinsen talking about Thanksgiving for about 8 minutes.
That was one
it's
of the funniest things.
And it is not micromanaged.
Who knew that
edited?
Doc Severinsen was a comedian?
Funniest.
Right.
Yeah.
He is so funny and so loose, and I think. Yeah. It's a shame that those moments kind of get edited out.
Absolutely.
Let's get our
audience.
We're
in these positions for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, and that's important.
But I couldn't believe, Scott, when you called me to play on at rehearsals, and I didn't know what the song you wanted me to play so you could hear.
Oh, right. I was conducting, for my
big band.
That's
some deep and hard music.
And I usually try and play my own stuff.
This was
because I find that
rich.
When you don't play and you're just conducting or writing, the players kind of you know, they have a different attitude about you. But when you actually sit down and play your own stuff, they sometimes it seems like you get a little bit more
respect,
I guess. But I didn't want to play that stuff. Are you kidding? It's too hard. I had to practice that for the record, though, you know.
I think TV gigs are unique in that they're constant and you're in one place.
And then when you want to do something creative, you don't want to do something that you've done a lot. You want to try and do something different.
But
so
it's
that's
easy
why
to fall
I try
into a rut.
Stay out of the box,
yeah.
You know, on my own stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I don't want to have a band that just... You know, does stuff inside the box all night. I want to.
Well, all you guys have that.
Yeah.
Have that hunger for newness. And
absolutely.
So I think that's the idea of even though you have a steady gig, keeping fresh outside the steady gig.
Yeah. Hard.
But not everybody does that.
No.
I mean, like, I don't want you to diss anybody, but just on the Bodie gig, like some of those, like Billy Kilson has been on it for a long time.
Yeah, he's been on it for like 10 years.
And he's a great drummer. I mean,
he
stopped playing with Dave Holland to do that full time, really, right?
Actually, Chris picked, made a call while he was in Japan with Dave Holland, and, you know, things worked out where Billy ended up playing with Chris. I don't play with Chris anymore, actually.
Uh-huh.
Jeff Keezer does it.
Slacker.
And they got some guy, Jeff Keezer. And when he doesn't, the, when he doesn't do it, they have another non-entity, Taylor Eigsteen.
Yeah, right, you know?
Who is like one of my favorites.
I was playing a quartet gig in Montclair, New Jersey, just in a restaurant in like, 1989 or 91 or something. And someone comes in and says, I got a friend of mine who's a 14-year-old piano player named Jeff Keyser.
Oh, it was Jeff.
Wants to sit in.
Yeah.
And did he?
Yeah.
Oh, no, that wasn't. He was not.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I know.
Man.
14.
But yeah, I don't play, I don't play with Bodie. Bodie's gig has changed a lot. When I first joined, it was like essentially a jazz gig. It was pretty much a quintet with a singer.
Uh-huh.
So it was like trumpet, piano, bass, drums, and guitar, and a singer.
And violin occasionally.
No.
Oh, no violin.
No, it was just a singer, and the singer sang like maybe two or three songs, uh-huh. and then the rest were instrumental, and and we kind of had a lot of room. As the show expanded over the course of years, that he started putting out albums that became more and more successful. He started doing making the show a thing,
uh-huh.
So then he added a violinist. Mm-hmm. There was a song that Michel Colombier wrote called Emmanuel, and I remember the first time we did it was at the Hollywood Bowl with an orchestra, and it got such an incredible response that we started doing it every show, So then the violinist would come in, and then the singer would sing more songs, and it became more like a show.
Right.
And still there was enough creativity to survive, I guess.
Sure.
For me. But I was able to, I would just bring my laptop on the gig, and if I would still
do your taxes on stage.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, got to do this QuickBooks.
No, more like my commissions. with Finale, I would take a pad and a pencil and then write out, I got a lot of practice writing without a piano because I'd write in hotels.
I do the same thing at Conan. I'm in the dressing room. Same. There's a lot of downtime. I'm working on stuff in Finale.
Yeah, yeah. And so I would do that. And I'd get, I'd still keep my commissioning thing. I had an agent. The Chris Bodie gig enabled me to save money in order for me to do my first jazz chamber CD.
Chris Bodie, I played with him and a lot of his friends in jazz groups.
Yeah.
He played about
capitalizing though on something. I mean, just like that's pretty brilliant.
And then he had Sting as a mentor. It turned
into a thing where the horn players would just sort of sit around and wait for the answering service to call them to go to sessions, and then suddenly they started forming these little horn sections that they would go out as a section and book themselves and try and get work as a section, and then no one would really put out a call for a horn section anymore. Get me, I need six horns for my session. Make the calls. There was an answering service that would do that. Mm-hmm. It would book the sessions, put it all together. Wow. That stopped. And then horn players would go out of sections. Rhythm section players would go out of sections.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then guys started doing rhythm section parts at home and then doing the horn sections in studios. Then they started having the horn players over to their house and recording them at home, because when Pro Tools came out, it was only four tracks. You couldn't really do a whole session at your house.
It was still eight ATs,
and it was still kind of hard. It was still better to go to a studio,
right?
And then
even for live drums.
And then one day they all closed. One day it was just like you just woke up and there was nothing, nothing happening.
Wow. Yeah.
Except creative jazz players who were starting to mix really good electronics with, starting with building on this sort of the Steps Ahead model, sort of really slick, good stuff, good music,
right,
with
programming.
With programming on top of it synced up to, a common code, time code, and, just building tracks. I mean, I remember Vince Mendoza was doing that in New York, and combining sort of the really hiring a lot of the top notch studio names and bringing them in and doing creative jazz music with synthesizers yeah. and horns and, you know, Pat Metheny type.
Yeah, with Lyle Mays.
Lyle Mays.
Yeah.
And Don Grolnick. Wyndham Hill. And Wyndham Hill was actually a very creative and yeah. innovative
like
record.
Like with Don Grolnick, Hearts and Numbers.
Yeah. That album is
yeah.
And ECM.
Yeah.
This is before we sort of got ossified. This is before smooth jazz became a dirty word and before, you know. Yeah. And before a new age became, before new age music was actually invented.
Yeah.
There were no labels.
Wyndham Hill was new age, but it was also, but it was creative and it was really happening.
And there were a lot of these bands like Oregon and all these other bands that were super creative, but then creative. Kind of got lumped in with new age.
Yeah.
Well, I got lumped in with new age. I was on Wyndham Hill jazz.
Yeah.
Well, they thought that by adding the word jazz, that was going to erase the stigma of new age music that Wyndham Hill itself had pretty much invented,
right.
You know?
They invented...
Yeah, George it's like Lewis. Saying Deutsch Grammophone jazz,
right.
You know?
Right.
Or Blue Note classical.
Well, Deck Up tried it too, right? And it's a couple of those, and obviously Nonesuch. Some of the classical labels did tack on the jazz. Hey, we're still legit. Here's that word.
Right.
But it's jazz legit.
Blue note classical.
Right.
You know, Blue Note country. You know? I mean, it just went like Wyndham Hill jazz, you know? So,
right.
Oh, but it's jazz because look at the
Tuck
word jazz.
Patty?
Yeah, well, yeah. Was Tuck and Patty on Wyndham Hill jazz?
Yeah.
Or were they on
Wyndham
Hill?
Wyndham Hill. Yeah.
Matt, that's not new age at all.
No.
And that wasn't even the jazz.
Wyndham
part.
Hill was Wyndham Hill was hip when they started.
Well,
it just
I
had
mean,
verb on the guitar, though. I'll tell you that. Those Tuck
well,
and Patty
had, like,
records had a lot of
like,
reverb.
They had like Philip.
That's true.
They had Philip Alberg, who was a great pianist.
Right. It was cool
they,
stuff.
They had who else? Andy Norell,
yeah.
You know, steel pan player.
Yeah.
Actually, Andy is why I got my deal with Wyndham
really?
Hill jazz. Yeah. He produced. He produced my CDs, he had a production company called Hip Pocket,
right.
You know.
That was his production company.
Yeah.
I just remember seeing it on your records. And
But I would, you know, like a lot of jazz DJs around the country would look at my album and say, oh, Wyndham Hill, that's a new one.
That's too bad.
And then
wouldn't even listen,
you know, and it had a hell of a time getting... it to Europe too, you know, because I theorize because of that. So it was
three albums for that label, and then Stretch
four albums. Take for example this Twilight Is Upon Us, His April Touch, and Portrait of a Player.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went to Stretch, right. You know.
And then were you labeled? Were you ever labeled as smooth jazz? Or did you escaped?
No, I don't think I.
He
I
never
think,
had a.
You never had that.
Actually, I did. It was my attempt at it. There's a song on, take for example, this called Timeless, which is kind of like...
it didn't have a loop like that, though, did it?
No, it didn't have a loop. You know, I couldn't go that far. You know.
Well, you always had stuff with Pocket. I mean, even with Joey and stuff, that always had like a...
Yeah, and Joey actually played on this particular one. That was me attempting to do something that was smooth jazz, radio friendly.
Get on the wave, as
and
was
it didn't get played. No. You know, yeah, my other stuff from that album got played more. I wrote a song called "Quiet Girl," which got played a lot. You know, but this one "Timeless" didn't get played that much.
Try to get in the box, and they don't want you
in
the box.
Yeah,
but then the box just changes, and you have to, you know, it has to be a certain thing now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It has to. It can't be dynamic. It can't have certain instruments. It can't have.
Right. It's true.
Know. I mean, I don't know the rules, but I hear there.
Well,
are
you
rules.
Don't want to know the rules.
I don't want to know the rules.
I don't think any of us would play by the.
But there was a day when we were slaving sequencers to live rhythm section, and creating really cool stuff with this new electronics.
Yeah.
Before digital recording, yeah.
I never did that. I've always been like kind of electronically illiterate.
Right.
Didn't you have somebody programming your synths? Were the synths programmed for somebody else?
Oh, Anthony Marinelli programmed most of all of my Wyndham Hill stuff and the Stretch record stuff. He programmed. He had back then the Cadillac of synthesizers, a Synclavier.
Oh yeah.
You know, which sampled a lot of stuff and. And so we used the synclavier on a lot, which was like kind of state of the art back then. And sure. They were great sounds. Anthony Baranelli is one of the most brilliant synthesizer programmers that I know. You know,
he's still doing it, right?
Well, he's composing.
That's right.
He had a really good career as a film composer, but now he's writing a musical. Oh. I think he's working on a musical with an Indian like. Musical writer.
Wow.
You know, and they're both collaborating, and he's doing well with it.
You know? But after all that, now it comes down to acoustic piano, Rhodes.
Well,
we're back in that now. Yeah.
You mentioned exactly, right. Love the Rhodes. I mean, and I always love the Rhodes too, and I remember when I got my first Rhodes from the recycler
right.
in Northridge for like $250, because in 80. Say that was 85.
Couldn't give them away, right?
Yeah. No, everyone wanted money for a DX7,
right?
And even then, I thought I want money to not have a DX7. My dad had a DX7, but
I never felt
that sound. I never felt right. anything from it.
No.
Brilliant instrument, but the Rhodes, I always felt.
Well, I sold my Rhodes when I bought a DX7.
You did, that's what you did.
And then in '93, I tracked it down.
You found the same one.
Same one. Three owners later, I bought it back.
How did you find it?
I called the dude, and he said, I sold it to so-and-so. I called him.
Oh,
I said, I sold it to so-and-so, and it ended up, it was in a warehouse in Hoboken, New Jersey, in a rehearsal, rock and roll rehearsal facility. It was, like, divided up into little rooms by plywood.
Wow.
Nice sound.
And it was
in a suitcase or
it
stage?
It was a stage.
Yeah,
you still have it? Too.
I had it. It was full of cat hair. The pedal was missing, but everything else was there, and... I bought a new pedal for an excessive amount of money.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, I still have my pedal, man.
I had it rebuilt a little bit, but it's pretty much the same Rhodes I had in high school.
I got to get mine, like, reworked on, you know.
Darren and I know a guy.
Oh, right.
Yeah. But there's another guy, you know, his name, but he has like a video about the Rhodes. Do you know this guy?
Oh, yes.
Sure.
Do you know that?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, Nir, maybe.
No, Nir. It's another guy. Nir is cool, too.
Yeah.
The Israeli guy. He's
I've worked
back,
in Nir.
Back in Israel, I think.
Oh, wow. Well, okay. So there's,
this guy did a movie about
Rhodes. About the Rhodes. I played it like at the Monk Institute gala like a month or two ago, and they had a Rhodes there. This was the best Rhodes I've ever, one of the best Rhodes I've ever played, and it was worked on by this guy, or provided by this guy's company, and it was like gold-plated and star-studded, you know, but it was beautiful, and it was not worked on by the aforementioned guy.
Yeah. We don't even, might even be a lady.
Well, if you go to the NAMM show, you'll see a couple of guys who actually, like,
Vintage vibe and
build new ones.
Yeah, and there's the new Rhodes.
The new Rhodes, and then there's the new like hybrid Rhodes Wurlitzer thing, which is pretty hip too.
Oh, that's cool.
And they have some really good ideas about how to rebuild, like my Rhodes.
In the last 10 years, they've gotten so much
better.
You were always playing one. I remember
that, man. Yeah, I mean, I
see when you know 90, 91.
Yeah, lug it out.
It was like a novelty then. I was like, dude. That's what it's supposed, like playing a piano. Like,
stop bringing that thing out.
I heard a gig.
KX88 and tell me that's a piano? No.
Right.
I heard a gig. Right. I heard a gig at La Vallée with you, Gary Novak, and Les.
Yeah.
All right.
And I was like, it was some of the baddest stuff I heard in LA up to that point. I was like, man.
So you were playing Rhodes when we were all playing KX88.
Yeah, I mean, he was playing Rhodes and clavinet too.
Yeah, exactly. But I did have
That's great.
I had, you know, the other gear as well, and I did have a KX88. That was my MIDI
controller
of choice.
Yeah, the working rig.
You know, and that was
commercial rig.
Yeah, that was a funny thing, especially because now if you go all the way back to '91, I wish I could now go back into the Miles trip with a Rhodes and a clavinet and re-record anything that I've ever recorded with. Because I had the rack of gear and I had, that kind of thing.
That was the thing. That's what kind of, he wanted it modern.
It was the modern thing. I would teeter. But I know when you saw that show, which was probably a year after that, the Miles thing, but just, clav and Rhodes, man. I mean, will forever.
It made me go out and buy a clav. I went like that next week. I went to David Abel, who is our father, who art in heaven, of piano, the piano patron saint of Los Angeles. He passed away maybe 10 years ago, but he sold me my my piano that I still have. Yeah, he was an angel, this guy. But anyway, I bought a mint condition. It was called a duo. It was a Hohner duo.
Pianette,
it was like
clavinet.
A pianette and a clavinet in mint condition from the 70s.
Do you still
he
have
gave it?
It?
No, I sold it to Anthony Marinelli.
Those are
excessively
rare.
Those are really cool.
Really, yeah.
But I sold that to Anthony Marinelli.
Oh, cool.
But I bought it for like, he gave it to me for like $250.
Yeah, no one wanted it.
It was still in the box.
Oh, man.
From the 70s, you know.
We have to do an Our Father for that instrument, too.
Yeah, exactly.
I actually...
You had new old stock clavinet and a duo.
That's like...
Wow.
I actually...
Reached the pornography portion of our podcast.
I actually went to our man, you know, to have him work on it. And he did a good job, but in between insults, you know.
It's so true.
But he did a great job on it.
Well, if I know now what I know... What if I know then what I know now?
Yeah.
I would have been playing organ too.
I know, right.
Because, we'll talk about rock and roll. Most of rock and roll from the 60s and 70s has organ on it.
Absolutely.
There's keyboard, piano and keyboard. Right. Piano and organ.
Or something. Yeah.
Piano and organ are like the backbones of rock and roll. Right. Screw electric guitar.
Right.
You know, pianists invented rock and roll.
Oh, that's
organ players played it. And even people like Chick Corea and Herbie Hancock played organ. They had organs.
Keith and Jarrett
had an organ.
Yeah, that's right.
He hated it, right?
Yeah, but
Chick had the CS-80 or whatever with Donald Fagen soloed on organ on.
That's the Yamaha.
Yamaha
YC.
Organ and. It took us all the way to the early 90s to rediscover the B3.
Right.
And where was it that whole time?
Well, I remember talking to
Sean racks.
Hopper from Huey Lewis in the News, who's a good guy, and saying, man, I'll never forget, you were the guy playing B3 in 80s music. You were the because you'd hear it poke out in these super synth brass things.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd hear a nice little Leslie creeping, that's nice.
Nice pack.
Thanks for bringing
that. What
layer
is that?
Yeah, right. I always really appreciated that because in the 80s, it was tough to find some earthy keyboard sound.
Yeah.
Everything was quantized.
Well, for B3 or C3, I just have two words, Keith Emerson.
Yeah.
That guy, I mean, I don't know how to play organ. I know nothing about it, but I know that guy kind of revolutionized. I mean, when I first heard him, because I had been listening to Richard Groove Holmes and Charles Erland on the organ and Jimmy Smith. And I thought that's what B3 organ was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Then I heard Tarkus, you know, and I was like, wait a minute, but that's that's that sound I dig, but it's playing this music. Man, who is this guy? You know, I was 14 at the time. And it turned my head around and made me want to play music.
Tarkus.
You know? Yeah. Pretty much.
Did you guys ever go to Jimmy Smith's club in the Valley?
No.
You know, I kept hearing about it.
I have a record live from the Jimmy Smith's.
Okay, here's another reason I should have.
In North Hollywood.
Right, you would have let us there probably. You'd have been like, yeah, you guys
where my house is. It's like an Armenian restaurant now.
Well, you know, I grew up, we both grew up around where the Parisian Room was.
Yeah.
The Parisian Room, I'd be driving there with my, you know, be driving past it, you know, with my parents on my way to somewhere and see Sarah Vaughan is playing there, Carmen McRae, Art Blakey, and before I even knew who these people were, you know.
You just remember the Marquee?
Yeah, the Marquee, and now it's a post office.
Well, that's a
progress.
Improvement. Well,
yeah,
with the Postal Service, maybe it'll become a jazz club again soon.
Yeah.
Probably got a better future.
Oh,
they'll sell stamps, though.
Yeah, you're right.
If you hang at the bar, maybe you get called for a session. I wanted to talk about your gig, too, which is fascinating.
Well, let's talk about it. Yeah.
All right. Darren's got a cool gig at Weinstein, being the house composer, which is amazing.
Yeah, man.
Didn't even know things like that existed in the world.
And they don't. Not rarely today. Mm-hmm. And I think the cool thing is that they used to exist a lot more 60, 70, you know, 80 years ago when it was first getting going. You know, Irving Berlin would be in a corner somewhere just churning out for some film company, you know. So, yeah, it sort of was created, you know, because you know, I guess the main thing is Harvey showed an interest in he's not a big jazz fan, but he's a fan of good music. It doesn't matter what genre, really, you know. But so when I would feed him certain things that were jazz like, because that's sort of in the fabric of my being, you know, he responded, but it was sort of, you know, housed in another, you know, set of clothing. But, you know, so that went on for a couple of years, you know, and I kept going on like, you know, hey, I'd like to be doing this more. Hey, I'd like to be doing this more. You know, in the top of this year, you know, he was just like, yeah, I'd like to bring you into the fold, you know? And I was like, what fold are you talking about?
The fold of making some money. The fold where you can fold them dollar bills in your wallet.
Yeah, right, that fold. I was like, oh,
the bill fold.
The bill fold. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so that's what it was. But then, you know, once you do a couple things that you know, somebody likes, and say you know, because big companies like that, it doesn't matter how much money they spend. You know, a successful company saves money, and anybody that could help them save money, then they pat you on the back and they say, right. Well, keep doing that. You know, so I did that on a few occasions, man. And then the amount of emails that would start to come in after that, you know, it was pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I had to find, you know, a small team of guys, you know, and so I found this amazing engineer mixer now who does all my stuff, and, you know, a sound designer who, you know, works with me on stuff. And then, you know, I'm scoring a lot of stuff, but there's, you know, a mock-up guy now, because a lot of it is not, as we were saying earlier, not recorded by an orchestra. Right. So,
sure.
Yeah. So it's for me, it's, well, I'll say this as well. I've known him for a long time, Billy. And I think I've always felt like doing, quote unquote, this is a funny word, but, or funny way to put it, but important music.
Mm. Yeah. That's
you know
a
what I mean?
Concept,
I came
though.
In and out of, yeah, the jazz scene is cool. The Young Lions are cool. Yeah, they're not cool. No, Alanis is cool. Seal is cool.
Right.
No, they're not cool anymore. Seasons. Like, I would just be like, you know, having an affair with everybody. You know, I mean, I'm all over the place.
Sure.
You know, but always in the back of my mind was like, and I think it's kind of what led me to sort of where I am now. Not having gone through, you know, a serious curriculum, but just like wanting to say, you know, come and see my concert, and it's being played at some theater by some, you know, and you see these subscribers in the audience,
yeah.
And you know, and now there's a vehicle for, there's a launching pad, in other words, for doing things like that. I mean, there's an agent that's come along now, and now I'm looking for another one. But there's, you know, a great agent who's, you know, pushing me along, you know, putting my music forward for certain mm-hmm. things, and you know, somebody like Harvey endorsing you. I mean, it's just doesn't get any better
great.
Than that in
yeah,
that in that world. You
yeah,
know?
Happy yeah. for
those
you,
the
man.
Kinds of things that should,
yeah,
should
respect. Yeah.
Yeah, it was,
I can't believe he met you at the baked potato too. That's
you know
that's
what I mean.
Amazing.
He comes walking. Wow. No, I'm just, he's like, "What is this?
This number 17 is delicious."
I like that guy.
I've never had a potato at the baked potato.
Not bad.
What?
Not
pretty good.
No.
Oh man, the steak one is
that's
yeah.
Really right. Nice. I saw the remains of a lot of them.
Yeah, that's great. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you, man. Yeah, yeah, it's
I mean,
been
yeah,
a long
so
time.
Cool
man. I appreciate
position.
It.
Position. I mean,
yeah, yeah, and it was
it
you know
happen.
Reporting to
happen?
An office.
Do you go to
you
work
know,
every
London.
Day?
Yeah, I mean, he wanted me to. You know, he put that in place because he wanted me to show up where they're in place because he wanted me to show up where they're in place because he wanted me to show up.
Exactly.
And he
never used to pop into the.
Yeah, you never know what could happen of meeting whoever you could meet and what that might lead to. It's
absolutely.
It's a great
interesting,
environment.
Interesting
yeah.
time where, well, at least maybe it'll have a renaissance, but where we haven't been seeing other people making
right.
our work. Where everyone is so
right.
isolated and
right.
so individual.
Yeah, yeah.
Nowadays,
yeah.
in the
no,
last
absolutely.
15
That's
years.
Why this podcast idea is a great idea.
Unbelievable man. Idea,
oh,
man.
It's like getting piano players. You know, we
say,
never. I don't think we
yeah.
met ever.
No,
I've you not. Know, and it's great to just get people in a room, and it makes it kind of a connection of you
yeah.
know that's kind of unique to Los Angeles. You know, it kind of creates a little scene in a sense. You
no,
know,
absolutely. Man.
You know, now if someone has a gig, you know, we'll maybe show up or something. And
I ain't showing up to none of y'all's gigs. I would tell you right now.
No way.
Come on, man, don't be like that.
Only because I'll quit.
Don't be
you know,
like
every time
that.
I see your gig, like every time I see those the chamber gigs, I'm kind of freaked.
Yeah,
both song and my wife's a violinist, and we both kind of come out way going.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what just happened, but I know my mind is blown, and it's going to take some time to come down.
Like,
I really?
I did come to one of your gigs at Vitello's, and I was turned away. It was sold out.
Really?
I swear to God.
Oh, man.
That's what chamber jazz will do, man. It just,
I mean, the doors were literally closed.
Really?
Like, no.
We're at capacity, man.
Well, that's because, you know, I get airplay on the radio with
that. Oh, yeah.
You know,
that.
Man, and all the people came, you know, out to see me. You know, I had, like, people say, hey, get your hands in the air like you just don't care.
Right.
Had Snoop Dogg with me.
You might have cared too much. Maybe that's why they threw it away. You cared a little too much to put your hands in the air.
But you've explored all the other avenues of artistic expression vis-a-vis the legit composition thing.
There's that word.
There's
you
that
got
word
the Chamber is. Music Chamber Music Award. You got that grant, right?
The Chamber Music America.
Chamber Music America.
Yeah.
And Guggenheim and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So that's
might
that's
as well throw in the Doris Duke in there too.
Doris,
yeah, that was a good one for me. Yeah.
These are all not easy things to get, or
well,
you
I
sort
mean,
of have to be in it to win it. And
God, I just sounded self-congratulatory.
No, we're doing it for you.
Oh, okay.
No, those are three
please
really,
continue.
You got three
fans. Really big and hard to get commissions there.
Well, it was I think it has a lot to do with endurance and longevity.
Yeah,
you know, I'm 57. I've been doing this for professionally for almost 40 years, you know.
Right.
That should win you something, you know.
It has.
And I've had, it's funny. I was on the road with Freddie Hubbard, and I'll bet Carl Burnett, the drummer, never knew this, but he kind of had a profound effect on my life. One day we're driving, and I was at a crossroads where I was where I could do something really commercial and really develop that, or I could, you know, kind of do what I want to do, where I feel is my calling. And I remember having a conversation with him, and he said, man, you should just do the thing that is your calling, you know. And for some, it seems like a very simple message. And the way he said it wasn't you know, erudite or anything like that, but it was just, he said
at that
it.
Moment.
But it connected. It was something I wanted to hear. And I said, you know, you're right. And something clicked, and I said, okay, I'm going to just make it a point to do the music uncompromising and exactly what I want to do.
Amazing.
And with no exceptions, you know. And I've stayed that course. Somehow, sometimes it's been really difficult,
sure. You
know, financially, because you get thrown out on a limb with no net, underneath, you know, and you're wondering where the next month's rent is coming from. And you're asking people to pay you because they like you, you know.
Right.
And that's, you know, you're always selling yourself.
Yeah.
You know, so if you get rejected, it's yourself that gets rejected,
sure.
pretty
yeah.
much.
They rejected me this year.
Yeah, really?
I mean, it didn't surprise me, but it was, you know.
For, who's they?
Oh, the Chamber Music.
Oh, Chamber Music America?
Yeah,
I've been rejected.
Really nice, I'm sure.
I've rejected a couple times, you know.
They
got me for the jazz composition thing, but there were two classical commission, three classical commission things that I got rejected for. Actually, the group that, you know, proposed it, that wanted to have me compose for them, they got rejected.
You just got to keep going.
You remain undaunted, and you just believe. What I tell a lot of composition students, you know, the first thing that they need to know before learning their craft, before learning, you know, anything, is to have faith in what you think, that your ideas are hip, you know. Because if you hear someone like Keith Jarrett or Brad Mehldau on the piano and you listen to that, you think, oh, man, there's no way I could do that,
right.
you know. But what you don't realize is that everything you're hearing from them is a surprise to you because it came out of their head. It's you're outside of it. But and so the person who is listening to your music, everything that you do is going to be a surprise to them, you know, and it's going to be like, how did they think of that? Because they're not you, so they couldn't think of it like you could have. So the first thing I tell people is to have faith in the strength of your ideas, you know, and then work like hell to on your craft. You know?
Exactly. We were just talking about that in the kitchen. Like you, I used the word branding, which is not probably the best, but it's a hip word to use these days. But you branded your style of, you know, your craft early. And you stuck with it. I mean, we were just talking about that, and here it is. It wasn't an accident. You set out to do that, but that takes a lot of balls.
Oh well, thank you.
And tenacity, like you said. I mean, yeah. It's not easy. Well,
it takes like when I started playing with Freddie Hubbard, I knew I didn't just want to be a jazz player, and it wasn't because I didn't like the music. Of course, I love playing with Freddie Hubbard, but. I also studied composition, and I grew up with, like, my mother played Bach around the house. My dad played Jobim, you know, Nat King Cole, Barbara Streisand. My mom would play Handel. You know, she liked the Baroque composer. So I would hear counterpoint, you know, since I was like this, you know, high. And
I have to just say, this explains a lot, because my mom listened to John Denver and the Carpenters. And I think I need to go back in time and get some shit worked out. This isn't okay. I realized where things went wrong. And I didn't have a choice. I was 4 years old.
Well, no.
You had Bach and
You came out. And, I mean, you did all right.
Richard Carpenter's a motherfucker. Let's be honest.
He is.
Anyway, please go ahead. Yeah.
But I listened to that, and then I developed, you know, this love for counterpoint, but I knew that you had to. My mom also instilled a work ethic in me, you know.
Well, that's a big deal.
I was kind of single-mindedly going after that. You know, I wanted to play jazz. I wanted to play classical. Yeah, you just keep going on and have faith in what you want to do, and it'll. And you'll arrive there.
Well, it's finding faith in the strength of your ideas, but it's also recognizing which of your ideas are the ones you want to develop and which ones you want to throw away, too. As a composer, you got to throw away a lot of that stuff, too. You got to, I think so. I think you got to, at least for the moment, figure out what to work on, what to develop.
What's interesting about that is that, you know, where some people, young people, might go, you know, south on that is that they don't either have the ideas,
right?
You know, which is a big deal, and that's innate or not. I mean, none of us are probably going to prove that point, but and then knowing that they're of worth to commit to.
Well, that's
everything's worth. I'm just saying within one piece of music.
Well, let's be honest. We've heard some compositions that may not be
of worth.
But just because they committed to it doesn't make it good.
That's true.
You know what I mean? So so how does a young composer know? And I think honestly some degree, there's natural selection. I mean, it's like, other people also agree that it's of worth, and they want to keep listening to it.
Well, someone said to me once, I can't remember who it was or exactly what it was, but it was like, basically, what is it that it is? What is it that you're doing here? What is it? What is this? Mm-hmm. You know, not what is this? What is this? What is this? You know, because your piece is going to have 10 different ideas, and probably that's probably 8 too many within one piece of music. So what is this? What is it doing here? And what opportunities are you missing when you write your third and fourth and fifth idea? What opportunities are you missing to work on your first and second idea?
And that's like a matter of craft and an understanding of structure. You look like you look at Beethoven, who's like a master of structure. You know, like taking a little cell of an idea and expanding it. And making it flow from one section to another, that's like an art.
And it happens in jazz piano with someone like Bill Evans. It happens in it evolves in a solo.
Yeah.
Or with Miles or with Bill Evans. Or with any great jazz soloist, but particularly those who play sort of compositionally. Yeah.
Sure.
You know, Ellington, writers, players who play like a writer.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And write, vice versa.
Write like a player, play like a writer, exactly. Right?
Yeah. We didn't get the chance to talk about Laura Nero.
Well, that's cool. Nominated let's, for let, Grammys.
Let's not talk about
no,
it.
No, but you know what? We should mention that it's out and that you should hear it because it's
yeah. Heavy. Yeah. I like it. It came out. Larry Klein produced it and I wrote the arrangements and kind of conceived of the idea. And Laura Nero is like one of my heroes. I mean, she's incredible. Singer-songwriter of the 60s and 70s who died, unfortunately, too young at age 49 of ovarian cancer at the same age, the same disease as her mother.
Wow. And revolutionary as a songwriter.
Oh, yeah.
And an influence on so many others.
Highly influential, you know. Influential on Joni Mitchell, you know. Influential on
Prince,
you know. The Prince?
Yeah. On the pop world.
Yeah, but yeah tons of... No, wow. Really. Like, there are the ton of pop composers.
It's like her and Jimmy Webb. It's like...
Jimmy Webb is incredible.
As far as, like, songwriters who, like, really... Yeah.
Talk about a craft.
The craft of songwriting.
Yeah.
And so young, to have her doing it so young.
Yeah,
so,
17, 18, you know.
So
kind of like Billy Strayhorn with Lush Life, you know.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
So you've reimagined or retooled some of the songs with different artists, and Larry Klein helped you put it together.
And it got nominated for 3 Grammys, and we're just going to leave that there.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Tune in,
William.
Yeah. 2 out of 3 well, ain't bad.
Ain't bad. Well, not to toot my own horn, but I was nominated for Grammy
last
year.
Get out of here. Really cool.
And that's the greatest feeling in the world.
For what? For this year?
Last year.
For what?
For a piece, composition. For
oh, right.
A piece off my record called Hudson City Suite.
I want to get that.
10. Yeah.
Can I get
probably
it on
should have brought some copies.
Yeah. Can I get it on iTunes?
You thousand can see of them sitting
no,
in my
yeah,
you can hear it. Not left.
Yeah,
you only got 4 left.
It's on Amazon and iTunes. And,
okay, right. I get it.
I got nominated for honorable mention backstroke in my swim team in 5th grade.
I just wanted
you guys to
cool.
know. I'm pretty proud of that.
Wow,
that's what I got.
Yeah, we won 2nd place in Battle of the Bands. Actually, 1975. Yeah.
That's the spot to have in a Battle of the Bands because there's a place
it's a sweet
to go
spot.
To.
That's right.
Yeah,
something to aspire to.
There's a band called Horde that beat us.
Motherfuckers.
Yeah. Horde. You know? And it was like the band was me, Larry Klein, and the drummer from Hiroshima, Danny Yamamoto.
Wow.
And we had a group called Triangle. You know?
And Horde beat Triangle.
Horde beat Triangle.
Look at that. So dreams funny. Can come true, folks. They overcame adversity.
Yeah.
And two-thirds
hard,
of Triangle created a Grammy-nominated...
It was hard, but we made it.
I just got that.
We fought.
The whole time
what happened to Horde?
Kind of weird.
If you're in Horde, I want you to reach out. Show us your Grammy nominations, Horde.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's big,
see what you got.
Horde. Let's have a big competition and a big competition about music.
Totally. Fuck Horde.
What's a better record?
Fuck those guys.
Horde. Is it with a W or... An H.
No, Horde.
Probably would have been better that way. Yes, yeah, right.
So many thanks to Billy Childs, Darren Johnson, Scott Healy. Our engineer for the first time on this show was Dave Schwerkelt. My name's Jeff Babko. Let's close by listening to the great Billy Childs playing the piano on episode 6 of Caffeinated Keyboardist. Thanks so much for listening. Take care.